REM band leader Michael Stipe points out very directly that the song Shiny Happy People doesn't fit in with the rest of their stuff. Compared to songs like Losing My Religion, It's the End of the World as We Know It, in the song I almost used in my last sermon when I gave statistics on depression, Everybody Hurts, Shiny Happy People could almost be from a different band. And in reality, they borrow a singer from a completely different group as Kate Pearson from the B-52s comes in to harmonize with them. In an article with The Sun, a UK entertainment news company, the interviewer suggests that Shiny Happy People is the odd man out on the specific album they're talking about. I can imagine Michael Stipe, the lead singer of REM, smiling as he replied. Though I bet he didn't smile. To me, they're all odd men out. Shiny Happy People is the odd man out for 7-year-olds. But we're throwing away the rule book. In fact, there's a common understanding that REM's members really don't like the song and don't like to perform it. To that, instrumentalist Mike Mills says, "I love it. When I listen to it, which is rarely, I really enjoy it. To write a non-tongue-in-cheek happy song is very hard." Stipe would go on to say that he grew up with the Archies, Sugar Sugar, the Banana Splits, and the Monkees. And this was their opportunity, and this was REM's opportunity to release a song that was perfect bubblegum pop. The band members were apparently trying to out-cheese each other, to which Michael Stipe said, "The guys would give me pieces of music that were so ebullient and bubblegum that I'd be like, okay, I accept your challenge and I raise you. We're going to call this one Shiny Happy People. It was written to be pop as it could possibly be. Absurdly, ridiculously pop." The song was released for children, and a few years later, Sesame Street came out with a new version. Mills says, "We might not have done other songs with the Muppets, but that one fit. They'd already rewritten it as Furry Happy Monsters, and we said, all right, why not? It's not as if we're tarnishing the legacy." I decided about a year ago that it would be easier to come up with new sermon content more often if I started doing series. Since I don't preach every week, I knew I wouldn't be able to do this in the traditional sense. In fact, I knew I couldn't necessarily build off of the prior sermons because there's a good chance, Unitarians that you are, you would not have heard my earlier sermons. Instead, I adopted the idea of sequels. Sequels that can stand alone or work as part of the whole, then be presented together later if I ever have the time to take my recordings and put online. I knew I could loosely connect two sermons without creating a specific dependence one to the other. And of course, in my own grandiose way, I thought, why stop at sequels? Let's do threequels. I mean, trilogies. We're all used to seeing amazing movies. At least I go see amazing movies. I don't know about you. And I know that they'll continue on, and I'll get excited over watching these characters that I fall in love with work together again with a deeper story. I love that idea personally, and I want most movies I see to get a nice, good sequel. I'm still waiting on sequels for The Legend of Billie Jean and Dirty Dancing. And I know what you're going to say. Dirty Dancing had a sequel, Havana Nights. And I will say very clearly and definitively, no, it did not. But I digress. When I decided to speak on self-care more than 2 months ago, I was trying to fit everything I wanted to do with the topic into one sermon. And it just didn't work. I was dovetailing way too many things and creating something broad and at the same time watering down this thing to the point it had no point. So even before working out the ending, like many Hollywood producers, I built my first sermon and just titled it One of Three. Because self-care is a broad topic deserving of time. So I started by asking you to take the Sabbath. Understand that our work is important, but not the thing that specifically defines us. Then I encourage everyone that maybe you take that day off and get a therapist. Okay, well, sort of. Maybe a better way to say it is, a good self-health regimen involves mental health too. And now we're ready to start part three in my theology of self-care. On May 16th, 1985, a man emerged from a limousine wearing a paper bag. He removed the paper bag as he took stage in the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, California. The crowd gasped as Tony Clifton took the stage. The well-known character was the brainchild of Andy Kaufman. But because of his reputation, no one was surprised to see him almost exactly a year after Kaufman's death. In this case, Andy's partner Bob Zemuda was dressed up like Clifton, which he would do frequently. However, most people couldn't tell the difference between the two playing the characters, so it fueled the fire that Andy Kaufman had faked his own death and had just retired from his life. And it also fueled the fire that Andy Kaufman had threatened to do this on more than one occasion. Over the last few weeks, I've been digging into the life of Andy Kaufman. But digging into the life of Andy Kaufman is like chasing a rabbit. I have read some that refer to him as a dadaist, and others that refer to him as an anti-humorist. And though he may represent ideas from both of these schools of thought, he preferred to think of himself as a performance artist. I believe the designation is important because it was important to Andy. Andy was often billed as a comedian, but he would say very clearly to anyone who would listen that he was not a comedian. He never told jokes. In fact, he really sort of made fun of stand-up comedy in his own acts. In a 1999 movie called Man on the Moon, named after a 1992 song by R.E.M., highlighting the life of Andy Kaufman, was highlighted and played by Jim Carrey. The movie is often easier to talk about because it presents his life in a linear progression, one thing happening after another, him not finishing, starting the next chapter till he finishes the past, where in reality, he was doing 100 different things at the same time, and he loved it. In the movie, they play out this conversation that probably never took place. At least not the way they shot it, but some form of the conversation at some point probably took place. He was being fired from a stage he wasn't even being paid to be on. The man said, "Tell some jokes!" To which Kaufman replied, "You mean like, take my wife, please?" See, Kaufman, who was a regular on Taxi as Latka Gravis, the foreign man, made it clear to all those close to him that he didn't care for sitcoms and considered them one of the lowest forms of television. He hated the idea of being limited to do one character, though he did appreciate that it gave him a national canvas to do the work he loved to do, which involved questioning the reality of the world around him. I actually watched reruns of Taxi growing up. I loved it, and I loved Kaufman's character, Latka. But it wasn't until the 1999 biopic that I really became interested and grew to love the things Kaufman did. In preparation for this sermon, I found myself watching so much Andy Kaufman, from interviews on David Letterman, wrestling matches, and his entire 1979 Carnegie Hall special, that my mind went a little hyper. I had a hard time sleeping. In fact, researching Kaufman has become one of my favorite sermon preps, but I found the deeper that I went, the more there was to find. Jerry Lawler, King of Memphis Wrestling, has talked more about his secret friendship to Andy Kaufman in the last few years, including the infamous slap on David Letterman. Lawler would talk about the hardest part in filming 1999's Man on the Moon. Jim Carrey, a method actor, came to set before anyone else, in full costume and makeup, as much in the mind of Andy Kaufman as he could be, forcing everyone to call him Andy. Lawler, who never spoke publicly about their friendship during Kaufman's life and in the years to follow his death, struggled to work again as if he was with his old friend. And though I laughed out loud when Kaufman panhandled for money to the studio audience on Late Night, and I lifted my arms in triumph when Lawler gave him a pile driver, neither of these things spoke to me of the heart of Andy Kaufman. The heart that some of his Taxi alum would say Jim Carrey could really never find. Endearingly, Andy sat during his special and had a conversation with Howdy Doody, the marionette. He was a marionette, right? Okay. He had this conversation with Howdy Doody, and at this time the show had already been off the air for 40 years. But it was like old friends catching up, and I can't help but notice this absolute boyhood joy in Andy as he talked with Howdy. In the conversation, Howdy reminds him that the things he was teaching the children were good for adults to learn too, that friendship is always worth the time. Andy closes his shows singing a song, asking everyone to sing along. And as he leads it, Kaufman comes into focus for me. In this friendly, friendly world, with each day so full of joy, why should anyone be lonely? In this friendly, friendly world, with each night so full of dreams, why should any heart be afraid? It's a friendly world. We should treat each other like brothers and sisters. When I preach weddings, I say very clearly and directly at the beginning, love is a choice. And in a similar vein, I say to you today, joy is a choice. But let me make something very clear about that statement. I'm not going to say happiness is a choice. Happiness is a feeling. I'm not saying we should live in a world like it's bubblegum pop. It's not. There are bad things happening. There are bad feelings in our hearts that cut deeply into our souls. However, saying that writing a song about happiness in a non-tongue-in-cheek way is difficult tells me something very clear about the world we live in, and in the theology I choose to do. It's easy for me to write about sadness, grief, depression, and pain. What does it tell you that it's hard for me to write about joy? And even when I talk about hope, it's in a Theodore Parker, Martin Luther King, long arc of history kind of way, which is very hard for me to grasp from a man on the street level. Andy Kaufman, when talking about comedy, talks about the funniest part being between the words, but in the silence. And I think a whole lot of stuff lives in that space between the words. Not just humor, but joy and hope. At least that's where I feel it. Universalism is steeped in joy. It's easy for me to focus on the pain of life because it's there. In the squeaky wheel, right? But I think it's also good for us to focus on joy. I started this journey way back months ago, giving the background story, the origin story. And I go back to the origin story. Genesis 1:3, God says, "Let there be light," and there's light, and it was good. God creates a dome in the sky, the sea, the dry land. And in 1:10 he says, it's good. God creates vegetation, and in 1:12 he says again, it's good. Sun, moon, stars, galore, all good. Fish, birds, good. Wild animals, beasts of the field, I'll give you a hint. God says it's good. And then in 1:31, Elohim looks down and says, I like it. Very good. And at no point does anyone ever say it isn't, which to me is pretty hopeful. Ecclesiastes 3, for everything there is a season and every time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh. My favorite, a time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw stones, a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek, a time to lose. A time to keep, a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silent and a time to speak. A time to love, a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. And I think it was added by the birds. I swear it's not too late. By Pete Seeger. I swear it's not too late. Our universalist heritage is sown in hope and joy, built into the idea that we are not predestined to fail, but to rise. That just because there are bad times doesn't mean we don't celebrate the good ones. I went home to bury my grandfather earlier this year. I never had the opportunity to go home and bury my Uncle Bud, who was the other preacher in the family. When he died, I pulled a Bible from my bookshelf that he'd inscribed in, and I held it to my chest, and I cried, and I fell asleep. He lived alone in Florida, and he was a man who did not necessarily feel accepted by the world around him. I never had the opportunity to say goodbye. I had a letter that I'd written him before he died that I'd never sent to say thank you. When I went home to bury my grandfather, we pulled my Uncle Bud's ashes that were still in the case in which they were brought home. And my aunt Holly says, Justin, come here. And she pulls out this gigantic mason jar. And she says, we've got to pour these ashes into these two mason jars. But you need to figure out how to open this cylinder because I don't know how. I said, okay. And I start working on the cylinder, and I said, and I yelled up for Aunt Holly, and she goes, shh. I said, what? You can't let your grandma know. Okay. Sure, why? Because she'll be watching every minute. Okay, fine. We won't let grandma know. We'll keep it a secret. Aunt Holly is up talking on the phone. She's left me to do this. I finally get the cylinder open, and I pull out the bag of my Uncle Bud's ashes. And it strikes me for a second, this is the man that I loved. And I take the twist tie off the bag, and I start slowly to pour the bag into the mason jar. And my Aunt Holly comes back down and says, how's it going? It's fine. I could use a funnel. So she goes upstairs, and she gets a funnel out of the kitchen. And she said, here. I said, this is Grandma's kitchen funnel. She said, I'll wash it. Because I guess that's how you purify something after pouring a body through it. So we start to pour faster because now there's a funnel and two people. She's holding the jar. I'm pouring faster. And I didn't know this about ashes. Ashes clump. And this clump of ashes falls. And it's the entire size of the funnel, and it goes poof, or poof. And I said, and we just looked at each other. I said, I didn't expect that to happen. So I went to go pick up the ball of ashes so I could break it, but they weren't clumped together that well. So when I touched the ball of ashes, they went poof, poof. So this is strange. And ashes are on the top of a garbage bag on the top of my grandmother's old refrigerator. Or it was a freezer, it was a deep freeze. And my aunt says, "Keep pouring." And grandma comes over, "What are you doing?" "Nothing, go away." "But what are you doing?" "We're taking care of it." And this is just, you can't imagine this thing playing out. She says, "So we finish, we get to the end, and there are ashes all over this thing." And I was like, "Okay." So I scooped some up, and I said very gingerly to my aunt, I said, "Do you think it'd be weird if I took some home?" She said, "No." She said, "Jerry!" Because he's in the lower basement where all the junk is. "Get an empty bottle!" He brings up a little empty pill bottle, and I pour some ashes in, and I start gathering up the ashes into the center of the thing, and I'm going to pour them into the mason jar. We actually did this in two mason jars. And I said, and Aunt Holly immediately grabs the corners of the garbage bag and she balls it up. I said, "I can dump those in." She continues to ball it up. She says, "We love them, God bless them." I said, "Yeah, but that's Uncle Bud's ashes." She throws them in the garbage and she says, "We love them, God bless us. God bless him." And I said, "But we can put the rest of it in. We love him. God bless him." And it is my joy to tell that story. It was my joy to spend that time with my aunt. To be able to laugh at this thing that's so dark that it's funny. So here it is. The finale. A Theology of Self-Care, Part 3. Seek joy. Because if we can't find joy, all the other work we do has no meaning. And if that's not good enough, because sometimes we're in a place where we just can't, because life is pushing on us, because things are pushing on us, and if that's happening, you're exempt right now and today. But seek joy. If for no other reason, because I told you to. Thank you.